Would you join with me in prayer?
May the words of my mouth and the meditations of all our hearts be acceptable to you, O God, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. The voice of Isaiah, as Peter has read to us this morning, has everything to do with the exile of the Jewish people from their homeland. It's a very long and complicated book in its composition, but basically it comes down to three parts. In the beginning, Isaiah is warning Judah that they're about to be gutted by an invading empire. In another section of the book, he consoles the people who have been living in diaspora. They've been sent away from home, and they're wondering if they'll ever get to come back. And then finally, in the end, Isaiah has been talking to the people who have actually come back home to Judah. So this book addresses a multi-generational process of fear, violence, and grief. From beginning to end, it covers about 220 years of Hebrew history. And I've been searching for a suitable analogy this week to help others understand what a monumental task Isaiah is trying to accomplish in this one book. Could there be one book that would tell the story of a similar arc in American history? The Lewis and Clark expedition to explore and map the territory of the Louisiana Purchase started in 1803, about 215 years ago. So maybe an appropriate analogy would be, what if there was a composite voice of the Native American experience over about 220 years? What would a Native American Isaiah say? How would they tell a story about the experience of anticipating violence, experiencing war, negotiating for land and civil rights, living in reservations? Maybe the story begins with peculiar sightings of white colonists coming closer and closer. Maybe it describes the grief of losing territory, the surprise that negotiating in good faith has only made matters worse, the anxiety of feeling pushed further west. Maybe a Native American Isaiah would speak to the memory of peace or yearn for the expansive life when there were no territories or states, or pray for the restoration of freedom. I'm just offering a possible analogy to show what kind of history the book of Isaiah is trying to speak to. It's the feeling of more than two centuries of living under duress. We have other examples too. The genre of African American literature is so distinctive, I think, because it lifts up those Isaiah voices. Is it not a particular strength of African American writing that it bears not just the story of one lifetime, but it speaks to the pain of several hundred years, the experience of many generations? Toni Morrison is an Isaiah voice, a black woman today who speaks to pain that was born long before she was. We read Frederick Douglass or James Baldwin, not just because they are speaking for themselves. They spoke to an experience that many others had borne in their bodies and carried in their hearts. These were Isaiah voices. They're the kinds of voices that can tell a story in three parts. Part one, how does it feel to wait for the wrath to come? Part two, How does it feel to be crushed by the forces of evil? And part three, now what in the world does it mean to survive? Paul writes from the perspective of a survivor too. These letters go to small clusters of Christians sprinkled throughout the Roman Empire. They're marginal communities that worship quietly and privately. And these churches operate under duress. Caesar has interpreted faith in Jesus as a threat to his earthly power. And Christians, likewise, interpret imagery associated with the empire as threatening to them or as idolatrous. But it's not just the state that the church fears at this time. Worshippers are also held in suspicion by their Jewish neighbors. Paul is thought to have been a Pharisee before he converted to following Jesus. He knows what danger his churches live with because Paul used to be one of the persecutors. These churches are surviving. They even seem to be growing and establishing new missions, but they're still living under very stressful circumstances. They may not be in captivity, but they sure aren't free. They have to watch what they say. They have to be careful where they go. They live day by day with worries and concerns that others, more privileged people, never have to consider. Early Christians lived on the margins. They were like people of color today, or immigrants, or LGBTQ people, in that their experience of the world exposed them to risks and insecurities that more privileged people didn't have to be bothered with. So the purpose of Paul's letter is to address divisions that seem to have arisen among them. And he writes to plead with them for unity. We need each other, he says. We're on the same team and we're already on the margins. We share the same purposes and life's not easy for us. We'll never survive the bigger threats that loom over us if we're fighting each other from the inside out. It's ironic, actually. Paul senses that the most imminent threat to the life of his community may not be a hostile empire, but internal conflicts within his church. And he's worried that stress will destroy them from the inside. And the Corinthian church has been troubled especially by a controversy that concerns speaking in tongues. This was an ecstatic expression of worship in which the Spirit speaks through you in language that others may not understand. It was controversial in Paul's time. It's controversial today. In the Corinthian church, a group of members has adopted this practice, much to the annoyance of other members in the church. I've never heard anyone speaking in tongues at United Church, but we have similar conflicts here. I mean, have you ever heard anybody complain about the new band in the fellowship hall? They're making too much noise. They might as well be speaking in tongues. All I'm saying is that Paul was dealing with a fairly run-of-the-mill problem in churches. We all have various tastes in music and worship styles, but we still have to live with each other. So notice how he goes about addressing the conflict. Surely there are members of the Corinthian church who wanted him to put a ban on this new practice. And undoubtedly there were others who were defenders of the garbled language who wanted him to support it. But I imagine that Paul senses that both sides of the debate have their own selfish motives. So instead of trying to please one side or the other, he disappoints everyone equally. What he addresses is not the content of the controversy, but the purpose of the community. Everyone has different gifts, he says, but they come from the same source. And the grace of God makes all of our differential abilities possible. Some may be given the ability to speak in tongues. Fine. And some may just as well have special gifts for teaching or for healing. There are varieties of gifts, but the same Spirit, he says. It's the same God who activates all of them in each of us. A dispute over worship styles in the ancient church may not seem so relevant to us now. But what seems more timeless to me are the questions that these texts raise concerning what it means to survive. How are we going to live together after all that we've been through? And some people here, make no mistake, I mean right here, like in this church, have really walked through the fire. They know what it means to be delivered from oppression. There are people in our midst today who could speak with the eloquence of Isaiah. They know that the pain they carry is not just the hardship of one lifetime, but of many generations. Martin Luther King Jr. Day is one of those occasions in our common life when we remember that the racial structures of our world predate all of us. And we carry in our hearts and our bodies the marks of a struggle for freedom that is as old as Isaiah. So how are we going to love each other then? When we didn't create the circumstances that put us here? When we have to live with the sins of people who came before us? When we've been shaped by the struggles of our ancestors? That's part of what it means to survive, to remember that we aren't creators of this condition, but that we have some choices to make about how we live with it. I think another thing we have to contend with is what it means to be surviving today. Like right now, in the circumstances of this toxic moment. And Paul tells the Corinthian church not to look for a role model in Caesar. If his community was going to survive, it was going to survive by a different way of life. Not one of mutual suspicion, but of trust. Not a way of life grounded in fearfulness, but grounded in graciousness. Not of brutishness, but of gentleness. See, even when we're resisting Caesar, we might still be influenced by the empire. The atmosphere that we live in is not asking us to be our best selves. And if we're not careful, we easily become little mirrors of the gracelessness that surrounds us. I mean, think about it this way. Isn't it interesting that the stalemate over a monument in our community here comes at about the same time as the shutdown of our government? My friend Juanita sometimes likes to laugh and say, we don't know the water that we're swimming in. It's shaping us. It touches our lives every day. We're touched by the insecurities and hostilities of this moment in our history. Are we giving the corrosive elements of our public life too much control over our souls? Are we speaking and acting on the terms of our momentary politics or from a more rooted and grounded place of love? That's where Isaiah and Paul have some agreement. Their communities survive because their people remain grounded in hope. For Isaiah, it's Babylon. For Paul, it's Rome. Be cautious, they say, not to be corrupted by your resistance. And that's another theme, incidentally, in the African American literature. Keeping one's humanity when the oppressor tries to take it away. There's a different way for us to survive, Paul says. And so we have all these lyrical verses that are easy to memorize from his letters. They just roll off the tongue. There are varieties of gifts, but the same Spirit. Love is patient. Love is kind. It is not envious or boastful or arrogant or rude. It's not resentful or irritable. It does not rejoice in wrongdoing, but rejoices in truth. It bears all things, hopes all things, endures all things? What kind of people do we want to be in graceless times? We don't have to adopt the ways of the world. We can choose to live differently, grounded in our hope, remembering God's faithfulness, turning to one another. These are the ways of Christ. These are the things that both Isaiah and Paul write to their communities to remind them of. Let us live likewise, from a deeper place, grounded in our hope. Thanks be to God.